unconscious. She had brain damage. The first in a long series of small cerebral hemorrhages had been triggered by the beating. She would never recover. Salander now understood why nobody had read the police report, why Palmgren had failed in his attempt to have it released, and why even today Prosecutor Ekstrom, who was leading the search for her, did not have access to it. It had not been written by the regular police. It had been put together by some creep in the security police. It had rubber stamps on it saying that the report was classified as top secret according to the law of national security. Zalachenko had worked for SEPO. It was no report. It was a cover-up. Zalachenko was more important than Agneta Salander. He could not be identified or exposed. Zalachenko did not exist. It was not Zalachenko who was the problem. It was Lisbeth Salander, the crazy kid who threatened to crack one of the country's most crucial secrets wide open. A secret that she had not known anything about. She brooded. Zalachenko had met her mother very soon after he had arrived in Sweden. He had introduced himself, using his real name. Perhaps at that time he had not yet been given a cover name or a Swedish identity, or he was not using it for her. She only knew his real name. But he had been given a new name by the Swedish government. That explained why Lisbeth had never found his name in any public records in all these years. She got the point. If Zalachenko were accused of aggravated assault, Agneta Salander's lawyer would start looking into his past. Where do you work, Herr Zalachenko? What's your real name? Where do you come from? If Salander ended up with social services, maybe somebody would start digging around. She was too young to be charged, but if the gasoline bomb attack were investigated in too much detail, the same thing would happen. She could imagine the headlines in the papers. The investigation would have to be conducted by a trusted person, and then stamped top secret and buried so deep that nobody would find it. And Salander would have to be buried so deep that nobody would find her, either. Gunnar Björk. St. Stefan's. Peter Teleborian. The explanation was driving her wild. Dear government, I'm going to have a serious talk with you, if I ever find anyone to talk to. She wondered fleetingly what the Minister of Health and Social Welfare would think about getting a Molotov cocktail tossed through the front doors of his department. But in the absence of anyone else who could be held responsible, Teleborian was a good substitute. She made a mental note to deal with him in earnest as soon as she had tidied up the rest of this mess. But she still didn't understand the whole picture. Zalachenko had suddenly sprung to life again after all these years. He was in danger of being exposed by Svensson. Two shots, Svensson and Johansson. A gun with her fingerprints on it. Zalachenko, or whoever he sent to carry out the executions, could not have known that she had found the revolver in the box in Bureman's desk drawer and handled it. It had been pure chance. But for her, it had already been clear from the start that there had to be a connection between Bureman and Zala. Yet the story still did not add up. She mulled it over, trying out the pieces of the puzzle one by one. There was only one reasonable answer. Bureman. Bureman had done his investigation into her life. He had discovered the connection. He had turned to Zalachenko. She had the video of Bureman raping her. That was her sword over his neck. Perhaps he dreamed that Zalachenko would force her into giving it up. She hopped down from the window seat, opened her desk drawer, and took out the DVD with Bureman written on it in marker pen. She had not even put it in a plastic sleeve. She had not looked at it since she had given Bureman his very own screening 2 years ago. She weighed it in her hand and put it back in the drawer. Bureman was a fool. If it only kept his distance, she would have released him as soon as he'd managed to get her declaration of incompetence rescinded. He would have been transformed forever into Zalachenko's lapdog, and that would have been a fair punishment. Zalachenko's network. Some of the tentacles went all the way to Svavelsjö MC. The blonde giant. He was her key. She had to find him and force him to tell her where Zalachenko was. She lit another cigarette and looked out at the citadel next to Skeppsholmen. She looked across to the roller coaster at Gröna Lund. She was talking to herself, and in a voice she had heard once in a film, she said, Daddy, I'm coming to get you. At 7:30 she turned on the TV to catch up on the latest developments in the hunt for Lisbeth Salander. She was stunned by what she saw. Boblansky finally got hold of Faster on his mobile just after 8 in the evening. No pleasantries were exchanged. He did not ask what Faster had been up to, but coolly gave him his instructions. Faster had had more than he could bear at the circus at headquarters that morning, and had done something he had never done before on duty. He went out on the town. He turned off his mobile and sat in the bar at Central Station, and drank 2 beers while he boiled with rage. Then he went home, took a shower, and went to bed. He needed to catch up on his sleep. He woke up in time for rapport, and his eyes almost popped out of his head when he heard the top stories. Bodies dug up in Nykvarn. Salander had shot a leader of Svavelsjö MC. Police hunt through the southern suburbs. The net was tightening. He turned on his mobile. Almost immediately, that fucker Boblansky called. He said that the investigation was now redirecting its focus to identifying an alternative killer, and that Faster was to relieve Hollenberg at the crime scene in Nykvarn. During the wrapping up of the Salander investigation, Faster was supposed to be collecting cigarette butts in the woods. Other people would be hunting Salander. What the hell did Svavelsjö MC have to do with all this? Suppose there was something to the reasoning of that fucking dyke, Murdig. It wasn't possible. It had to be Salander. He wanted to be the one who caught her. He wanted to catch her so badly that it almost made his hands hurt as he held his mobile. Palmgren calmly watched Blomqvist pace back and forth in front of the window in the small room. It was getting on towards 7:30 in the evening, and they had been talking non-stop for almost an hour. At last Palmgren tapped on the tabletop to get Blomqvist's attention.
"Sit down before you wear out your shoes," he said.
Blomqvist sat down.
"All these secrets," Palmgren said. "I never understood the connection until you explained Zalachenko's background. All I've seen are the assessments of Lisbeth claiming that she's mentally disturbed."
"Peter Teleborian."
"He must have some sort of deal with Björk. They have to have been working together somehow."
Blomqvist nodded pensively. Whatever happened, Teleborian was going to be the object of journalistic scrutiny. "Lisbeth said that I should stay away from him, that he was evil." Palmgren looked at him sharply.
"When did she say that?"
Blomqvist said nothing for some moments, then he smiled and looked at Palmgren.
"More secrets, damn it.
I've been in touch with her while she's been in hiding. By computer. Only short, cryptic messages on her part, but she has always led me in the right direction." Palmgren sighed.
"And of course you didn't tell the police."
"No. Not exactly."
"Then you haven't told me either. She's quite good with computers." "You have no idea how good." "I have a great belief in her ability to land on her feet. She may be hard up, but she's a survivor."
"Not that hard up. She stole almost 3 billion kroner. She's not going to starve. She has a bag full of gold, just like Pippi Longstocking." "What I don't quite understand," Blomqvist said, "is why you didn't take up her case in all those years." Palmgren sighed again. He felt infinitely sad.
"I failed her," he said. "When I became her trustee, she was only one in a series of difficult young people with problems. I've dealt with dozens of others. I was given the assignment by Stefan Brohinsjö when he was Minister of Welfare. By then she was already at St. Stefan's, and I didn't even see her that first year. I talked to Teleborian a couple of times, and he explained that she was psychotic and that she was getting the best possible care.
I believed him. And why not? But I also talked to Jonas Berenger, who was senior clinician at that time. I don't think he had anything to do with her case. He made an assessment at my request, and we agreed to try and get her back into society again by way of a foster family. That was when she was 15. And you backed her up over the years? Not enough. I took her side after the episode in the Tunnelbana. By then I had gotten to know her, and I liked her a lot. She was feisty. I stopped them from putting her back in an institution. The price of that was that she was declared incompetent, and I became her guardian. Presumably, Björk wasn't running around telling the court what to decide. It would have attracted attention. He wanted her locked up, and he counted on painting a bleak picture of her through psychiatric assessments from Teleborian and others, assuming that the court would come to the logical conclusion. But instead they followed your recommendation. I've never thought that she ought to be under guardianship. But, to be honest, I didn't do much to get the ruling reversed. I should have acted sooner and more forcefully. But I was quite enchanted by Lisbeth, and I always put it off. I had too many irons in the fire. And then I got sick.
I don't think you should blame yourself. No one else looked after her interests better over the years.
The problem was always that I didn't know enough. Lisbeth was my client, but she never uttered a word about Zalachenko. When she got out of St. Stefan's, it was years before she manifested the slightest trust in me. It was only after the hearing that I sensed she was very slowly starting to communicate with me beyond the necessary formalities.
How did she happen to start telling you about Zalachenko?
I suppose that in spite of everything she had begun to trust me. Besides, on a number of occasions I'd raised the subject of having the incompetency declaration rescinded. Apparently she thought it over, and then one day she called and wanted to meet, and she told me the whole story about Zalachenko and how she viewed what had happened. You'll probably appreciate that it was a lot for me to take in. But I started digging around in the story straight away. I couldn't find a Zalachenko in any database in all of Sweden. I did sometimes wonder whether she might be imagining the whole thing.
After you had your stroke, Bjurman became her guardian.
That couldn't have been an accident.
No.
I don't know if we'll ever be able to prove it, but I've been thinking that if we tried hard enough, we would find whoever it is that took over after Björk and is in charge of the clean-up of the Zalachenko affair.
I don't wonder at Lisbeth's absolute refusal to talk to psychiatrists or the authorities, Blomqvist said. Every time she did it, it only made matters worse. She tried to explain what had happened, and no one listened. She, a child all by herself, tried to save her mother's life and defend her against a psychopath. In the end, she did the only thing she felt she could do. And instead of saying, well done and good girl, they locked her up in an asylum.
It's not that straightforward. I hope you understand that there really is something wrong with Lisbeth,
Palmgren said sharply. How do you mean?
You're aware that she had a lot of trouble when she was growing up, and problems in school and all that.
It's been in every daily paper, and I would have had trouble in school myself if I'd had the childhood she had.
Her problems go way beyond the problems she had at home. I've read all the psychiatric assessments, and there isn't even a diagnosis. I think we can agree that Lisbeth Salander isn't like normal people. Have you ever played chess with her?
No.
She has a photographic memory.
I know. I realized that when I was working with her.
She loves puzzles.
One time when she came over for Christmas dinner, I enticed her into solving some problems from a Mensa intelligence test. It was the kind where they show you 5 similar symbols and you have to decide what the 6th one will look like. I'd tried myself and got about half of them right, and I plodded away at it for 2 evenings. She took one look at the paper and answered every question correctly.
Lisbeth is a very special girl.
She has an extremely hard time relating to other people. I thought she had Asperger's syndrome or something like it. If you read the clinical descriptions of patients diagnosed with Asperger's, there are things that seem to fit Lisbeth very well, but there are just as many symptoms that don't apply at all. Mind you, she's not the least bit dangerous to people who leave her in peace and treat her with respect. But she is violent, without a doubt, said Palmgren in a low voice. If she's provoked or threatened, she can strike back with appalling violence.
Blomqvist nodded.
The question is, what do we do now? Palmgren said.
We find Zarachenko, Blomqvist said.
At that moment, Dr. Sivanandan knocked and came in.
I hope I'm not disturbing you, but if you're interested in Lisbeth Salander, you might want to turn on the TV and watch the news.
Chapter 29. Wednesday, April 6th to Thursday, April 7th. Salander was shaking with rage. That morning she had gone to Bureman's summer cabin in peace and quiet. She hadn't opened her computer since the night before, and during the day she had been too busy to listen to the news. She was half expecting the incident in Stallarholmen to get a mention, but she was completely unprepared for the storm that she now encountered on the TV news. Miriam Wu was in Surda Hospital, attacked and badly wounded by a gigantic assailant who'd kidnapped her outside the apartment building on Lundegarten. Her condition was described as serious. She'd been rescued by the former professional boxer Paolo Roberto. How he had come to be in a warehouse in Nykvarn was not explained. He was mobbed by reporters when he came out of the hospital, but he didn't want to make any comments. His face looked as if he had gone 10 rounds with his hands tied behind his back. 2 bodies had been found buried in the woods close to where Miriam Wu had been assaulted. It was reported that the police had designated a 3rd site to be excavated as well, and that this might not be the last of it. And then there was the search for the fugitive Lisbeth Salander. The net, so they said, was tightening. That day the police had surrounded the neighbourhood of Stallarholmen. She was armed and dangerous. She had shot and wounded a Hell's Angels biker, possibly 2. The shootout had taken place at the summer cabin of the murdered lawyer Niels Bjørman. By evening the police were ready to concede that she might have managed to elude the cordon. Ekström had called a press conference. His responses were evasive. No, he could not say whether Salander had dealings with the Hell's Angels. No, he could not confirm the rumour that Salander had been seen at the warehouse in Nykvarn. No, there was nothing to indicate that this was an underworld gang war. No, it could not be confirmed that Salander alone was responsible for the Enschede murders. They were now searching for her solely to question her about the circumstances of the murders. Salander frowned. Something had shifted within the police investigation. She went online and first read the newspaper's reports, then accessed the hard drives of Ekström, Armansky and Blomqvist one by one. Ekström's email contained several messages of interest, in particular a memo sent by Jan Bublansky at 5:22 p.m. The email was brisk and devastatingly critical of Ekström's management of the preliminary investigation. It ended with what was effectively an ultimatum. It demanded, A, that Inspector Murdoch be reinstated, effective immediately, B, that the focus of the investigation be redirected so as to explore alternative solutions to the Enschede murders, and C, that research be started without delay on the figure known only as Zala.
The accusations against Salander are based on a single direct piece of evidence, her fingerprints on the murder weapon, which, I remind you, is proof that she handled the weapon, but no proof that she fired it, and even less that she fired it at the murder victims. We now know there are other players involved. The Sud-Italia police have found, so far, two bodies in shallow graves close to a warehouse owned by a cousin of Carl Magnus Lundin. It should be obvious that Salander, however violent and whatever her psychological profile, had nothing to do with those deaths.
Poblansky finished by saying that if his demands were not met, he would leave the investigative team, which he did not intend to do quietly. Ekstrom had replied that Poblansky should do what he thought was best. Salander obtained even more surprising information from Armansky's hard drive. A brief exchange of emails with Milton's payroll office established that Niklas Hedström had left the company, effective immediately. He would get vacation pay and 3 months' severance. An email to the manager on duty stated that if Hedström came back to the building, he could be escorted to his desk to remove personal effects, and then escorted from the premises. An email to the technical department advised them that Hedström's card key was to be devalidated. But most interesting was an exchange between Armansky and Milton Security's lawyer, Frank Alenius. Armansky asked how Salander could best be represented in the event that she was taken into custody. Alenius replied that there was no reason for Milton to become concerned with a former employee who had committed murder. It would not reflect well upon Milton Security were the company to be so involved. Armansky replied brusquely that Salander's involvement in any murder was still an open question, and that his concern was to provide support for a former employee whom he considered innocent. Blomqvist had not, Salander discovered, been on his computer since early the previous day. So, no news. Bowman laid the folder on the table in Armansky's office. He sat down heavily. Freckland opened it and began to read. Armansky stood by the window looking out at Gamlestaden.
"This is the last report I can deliver. I've been kicked off the investigation," Bowman said.
"Not your fault," Freckland said.
"No, not your fault,"
Armansky said and sat down. He had collected all the material that Bowman had provided over the course of 2 weeks in a pile on the conference table.
"I talked to Poblansky. You've done a good job, Sonny. He is sorry to lose you, but he had no choice because of Hedström."
"That's okay. I discovered that I get along much better here at Milton than down at Kungsholmen."
"Can you give us a summary?"
"Well, if the objective was to find Lisbeth Salander, then obviously we failed. It was a very messy investigation with a number of competing personalities, and Poblansky may not have had ultimate control over the search."
"Hans Faster?"
"Faster is a real fuck-up. But the problem is not just Faster and a sloppy investigation. Poblansky saw to it that all the leads were followed as far as they could be. The fact is, Salander has been damn good at covering her tracks."
"But your job wasn't only to pin down Salander," Armansky said.
"No. And I'm thankful that we didn't tell Hedström about my other assignment to act as your mole and see to it that Salander wasn't falsely accused."
"And what do you think today?"
"When we started, I was positive that she was guilty. Today I'm not sure one way or the other. So many things don't fit."
"Yes?"
"Well, I would no longer consider her the prime suspect. I'm leaning more and more towards thinking there's something to Mikael Blomqvist's reasoning."
"Which means that we have to identify and find the killers. Shall we take the investigation from the beginning?"
Armansky said, pouring coffee. Salander had one of the worst evenings of her life. She was thinking about when she had thrown the firebomb into Zalachenko's car. In that instant, the nightmares stopped, and she had felt a great inner peace. She had had other problems, but they had always been about her, and she could handle them. Now it was about Mimi. Mimi had been beaten up and was in the hospital. She was innocent. She'd had nothing to do with any of this. Her only crime was that she knew Salander. She cursed herself. She was riddled with feelings of guilt. The blame was all hers. Her address was secret. She was safe. and then she had persuaded Mimi to live in her apartment at the address that anyone could find. How could she have been so thoughtless? She might as well have beaten her up herself. She felt so wretched that tears came to her eyes, but Salander never cried. She wiped them away. At 10:30 she was so restless that she could not stay in the apartment. She put on her coat and boots and set off into the night. She walked down side streets until she reached Ringvegen and stood at the end of the driveway to Söder Hospital. She wanted to go to Mimi's room and wake her up and tell her that everything was going to be all right. Then she saw blue lights from a police car near Zinken and stepped into an alleyway to avoid being seen. She was home again just after midnight. She was freezing, so she undressed and crawled into bed. She could not sleep. At 1 a.m. she was up again, walking naked through the unlit apartment. She went into the guest bedroom, where there was a bed and a desk. She had never set foot in it before. She sat on the floor with her back to the wall and stared into the night. Lisbeth Salander has a guest bedroom. What a joke. She sat there until after 2, and by then she was so cold that she was shivering. Then she started to cry again. Sometime before dawn, Salander took a shower and dressed. She put on the coffee maker and made breakfast and turned on her computer. She went into Blomqvist's hard drive. She was surprised to discover that he had not updated his research journal, and instead she opened the folder Lisbeth Salander. There was a new document titled Lisbeth Important. She looked at the document properties. It had been created at 12:52 a.m. She double-clicked.
Lisbeth, contact me right away. This story is worse than I could have dreamed. I know who Zalachenko is, and I think I know what happened. I've talked to Holger Palmgren. I understand Teleborian's role and why they locked you up at the clinic. I think I know who murdered Dag and Mia. I also think I know why, but I'm missing some crucial pieces of information. I don't understand Bjurman's role. Call me. Contact me at once. We can solve this. Mikael.
Salander read the document slowly again. Kalle Blomqvist had been busy. Practical pig. Practical fucking pig. He still thought there was something to solve. He meant well. He wanted to help. He didn't understand that whatever happened, her life was over. It had ended before she even turned 13. There was only one solution. She created a new document and tried to write a reply, but the thoughts were whirling around in her head and there were so many things she wanted to say to him. Salander in love. What a fucking joke. He would never find out. She would never give him the satisfaction. She deleted the document and stared at the empty screen. But no answer at all was less than he deserved. He had stood faithfully in her corner like a steadfast tin soldier. She created a new document and wrote, "Thanks for being my friend." First, she had a number of logistical decisions to take. She needed a means of transport. Using the burgundy Honda still on Lundegarten was tempting but out of the question. There was nothing in Prosecutor Ekström's laptop to indicate that anyone in the police investigation had discovered that she had bought a car, which might be because she had not yet managed to send in the registration documents and insurance papers. But Mimi might have talked about the car when she was questioned by the police, and obviously Lundegarten was under sporadic surveillance. The police knew that she had a motorcycle, and it would be even more obtrusive to take it out of storage from the apartment building on Lundegarten. Besides, after a number of summer-like days, a change in the weather was forecast, and she had no great desire to venture out on a bike on rain-slick highways. One alternative, of course, would be to rent a car in Irene Nessa's name. But there were risks involved with that, too. Someone might recognize her, and the fake identity would then be lost to her. That would be a catastrophe. It was her escape route out of the country. Then she gave a lopsided smile. There was one other possibility. She booted up her computer, logged on to Milton Security's network, and navigated to the carpool, which was administered by a secretary in Milton's reception area. Milton Security had close to 40 cars at its disposal, some of which carried the company logo and were used on business trips.
The majority were unmarked surveillance cars, and these were kept in the garage at Milton's HQ near Slusen, practically around the corner. She studied the personnel files and chose employee Marcus Collander, who had just gone on vacation for 2 weeks. He had left the telephone number of a hotel in the Canary Islands. She changed the hotel name and scrambled the digits of the phone number where he could be reached. Then she entered a note that Collander's last action while on duty had been to drop off one of the cars for servicing. She picked a Toyota Corolla automatic, which she had driven before, and recorded that it would be back a week later. Finally, she went into the surveillance system and reprogrammed the cameras she would have to walk past. Between 4:30 and 5 a.m., they would show a repeat of the previous half hour, but with an altered time code. At 4:15, she packed her backpack. She had 2 changes of clothes, 2 mace canisters, and the fully charged taser. She looked at the 2 guns she had acquired. She rejected Sandstrom's Colt 1911 government and chose Niemann's Polish P-83 Vanat, which had 1 round missing from the magazine. It was slimmer and fit her hand better. She put it into her jacket pocket. Salander closed the lid of her power book but left the computer on the desk. She had transferred the contents of her hard drive to an encrypted backup on the net, and then erased her whole hard drive with a program she had written herself, which guaranteed that not even she could reconstruct the contents. She did not want to rely on her power book, which would just be cumbersome to drag around. Instead, she took her palm tungsten PDA with her. She looked around her office. She had a feeling that she would not be coming back to the apartment in Mosebacke, and knew that she was leaving secrets behind that she should probably destroy. But glancing at her watch, she realized that she did not have much time. She turned off the desk lamp. She walked to Milton Security, went into the garage, and took the elevator up to the administrative offices. She met no one in the empty corridors, and taking the car keys out of the unlocked cabinet in reception presented no difficulty. She was in the garage 30 seconds later and blipped open the door lock on the Corolla. She dumped her backpack in the passenger seat and adjusted the driver's seat and the rearview mirror. She used her old card key to open the garage door. Just before 5, she turned up from Söder Mellastrand at Västerbron. It was starting to get light. Blomqvist woke at 6:30. He had not set his alarm clock and had slept for only 3 hours. He got up and switched on his iBook and opened the folder Lisbeth Salander to look for her reply.
"Thanks for being my friend."
Blomqvist felt a chill run down his spine. Hardly the answer he had hoped for. It felt like a farewell letter. Salander alone against the world. He went to the kitchen and started the coffee maker and then had a shower. He put on a pair of worn jeans and realized that he had not had time to do laundry for weeks. He had no clean shirts. He put on a wine-red sweatshirt under his grey jacket. As he made breakfast in the kitchen, a glint of metal on the counter behind the microwave caught his eye. With a fork, he fished out a key ring. Salander's keys. He had found them after the attack on Lundegarten and put them on top of the microwave with her shoulder bag. He had forgotten to give them to Inspector Murdig with the bag, and they must have fallen down in back. He stared at the bunch of keys. 3 large ones and 3 small. The 3 large keys were presumably to an entrance door, an apartment, and a deadbolt. Her apartment? Obviously not the apartment on Lundegarten. So where the hell did she live? He examined the 3 small keys more closely. One was probably for her Kawasaki. One looked like it was for a safety deposit box or storage cabinet. He held up the 3rd key. The number 24914 was stamped on it. The realization hit him. A P.O. box. Lisbeth Salander has a P.O. box. He looked up the post offices in Södermalm in the phone book. She had lived on Lundegarten. Ringvägen was not too far away. Maybe Hornsgarten or Rosenlundsgarten. He turned off the coffee maker, abandoned his breakfast, and drove Berger's BMW to Rosenlundsgarten. The key did not fit. He drove on to Hornsgarten. The key fit perfectly in box 24914. He opened it and found 22 items of post, which he stuffed into the outside pocket of his laptop case. He drove on to Hornsgarten, parked by the Kvarta cinema, and had breakfast at Copacabana on Bergsundstrand.
As he waited for his café latte, he examined the letters one by one. All were addressed to Wasp Enterprises. 9 letters had been sent from Switzerland, 8 from the Cayman Islands, 1 from the Channel Islands, and 4 from Gibraltar. With no pang of conscience, he slit open the envelopes. The first 21 contained bank statements and reports on various accounts and funds. Salander was as rich as a troll. The 22nd letter was thicker. The address was handwritten. The envelope had a printed logo and the return address of Buchanan House, Queensway Quay, Gibraltar. The enclosed letter was on the stationery of a Jeremy S. Macmillan solicitor. He had neat handwriting.
"Dear Miss Salander, this is to confirm that the final payment on your property was concluded as of January 20th. As agreed, I am enclosing copies of all documentation, but I will keep the original set. I trust this will meet with your satisfaction. Let me add that I hope everything is well with you. I very much enjoyed your surprise visit of last summer, and must tell you that I found your company refreshing. I look forward to being of further service as necessary. Yours sincerely, J.S.M.
The letter was dated January 24th. Salander apparently did not pick up her mail very often. Blomqvist looked at the attached documentation for the purchase of an apartment in a building at Fiskargarten 9 in Mosebacke. Then he almost choked on his coffee. The price paid was 25 million kroner, and the deal was concluded with 2 payments a year apart. Salander watched a solid, dark-haired man unlock the side door of Auto Expert in Eskilstuna. It was a garage, a repair shop, and a car rental agency. A typical franchise. It was 6:50, and according to a handwritten sign on the front door, the shop did not open until 7:30. She went across the street and followed the man through the side door into the shop. The man heard her and turned round.
"Refik Alba?" she said.
"Yes. Who are you?"
"I'm not open yet."
She raised Niemannen's P-83 Vanat and held the weapon with 2 hands aimed at his face.
"I don't want to haggle with you. I just want to see your list of cars rented out. I want to see it now. You have 10 seconds to produce it."
Refik Alba was 42 years old, a Kurd, born in Diyarbakir, and he had seen his fill of guns. He stood as if paralyzed. Then he concluded that if this crazy woman came into his garage with a pistol in her hand, there was not going to be much to discuss.
"It's on the computer," he said.
"Turn it on."
He did as she told him.
"What's behind that door?"
she asked, as the computer booted up and the screen began to flicker.
"It's just a closet."
"Open it."
It contained some overalls.
"Okay. Go into the closet, stay calm, and I won't have to hurt you."
He obeyed her without protest.
"Take out your mobile, put it on the floor, and kick it over to me."
He did as she said.
"Good. Now close the door behind you."
It was an antique PC with Windows 95 and a 280-megabyte hard drive. It took an eternity to open the Excel document with the car rental listing. The white Volvo had been rented on 2 occasions, first for 2 weeks in January and then from March 1st. It had not yet been returned. He was paying a weekly fee for a long-term rental. The name was Ronald Niedermann. She looked through the folders on the shelf above the computer. One of them had the label Identification printed neatly on it. She took the folder down and paged through to Ronald Niedermann. When he rented the car in January, he had given his passport as ID, and Refik Alba had made a photocopy. She recognized the blonde hulk at once. According to the passport, he was German, 35 years old, born in Hamburg. The fact that Alba had made a copy from the passport showed that Niedermann was just a customer, not a friend. At the bottom of the page, Alba had written a mobile number and a P.O. Box address in Göteborg. Salander replaced the folder and turned off the computer. She looked around and found a rubber doorstop next to the front door. She picked it up and went back to the closet and knocked on the door with the barrel of her gun.
"Can you hear me in there?"
"Yes."
"Do you know who I am?"
Silence.
"He'd have to be blind not to recognize me." "Okay, you know who I am. Are you afraid of me?"
"Yes."
"Don't be afraid of me, Herr Alba. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm almost finished here. I'm sorry for putting you to this trouble." Okay.
Have you got enough air to breathe in there?
Yes.
What do you want, anyway? I wanted to see whether a certain woman had hired a car from you 2 years ago, she lied. I didn't find what I wanted, but it's not your fault. I'll be leaving in a few minutes. I'm going to put the doorstop under the closet door here. The door is thin enough for you to break your way out, but it will take a while. You don't have to call the police. You'll never see me again, and you can open up as usual today and pretend that this never happened. The chances of him not calling the police were pretty remote, but it did not hurt to give him the option to think about. She left the garage and walked to the Toyota Corolla around the corner, where she swiftly changed into Irene Nessa. She was annoyed not to have found a street address for Ronald Niedermann in the Stockholm area, just a P.O. box address on the other side of Sweden, but it was the only lead she had. So, to Göteborg. She made for the E20 and turned west, towards Arboga. She turned on the radio, but she had just missed the news and got some commercial station. She listened to David Bowie singing "Putting Out Fire with Gasoline." She didn't know the name of the song, but she took the words as prophetic. Chapter 30. Thursday, April 7th. Blomqvist looked at the entrance door of Fiskargatan 9. It was one of Stockholm's most exclusive addresses. He put the key in the lock, and it turned perfectly. The list of residents in the lobby was no help. Blomqvist assumed it would be mostly corporate apartments, but there seemed to be one or two private residences among them. It hardly surprised him that Salander's name was not listed, yet it still seemed unlikely that this would be her hideout. He walked up, floor by floor, reading the nameplates on the doors. None of them rang a bell. Then he got to the top floor and read, V. Kulla. Blomqvist slapped his forehead. He had to smile. The choice of name may not have been intended to make fun of him personally. It was more likely some private ironic reflection of Salander's. But where else should Kalle Blomqvist, nicknamed for an Astrid Lindgren character, look for her than at Pippi Longstocking's Villa Villa Kulla? He rang the doorbell and waited a minute. Then he took out the keys and unfastened the deadbolt and the bottom lock. The instant he opened the door, the burglar alarm device was activated. Salander's mobile began beeping. She was near Glanshammer, just outside Örebro. She braked and pulled onto the shoulder. She took her palm from her jacket pocket and plugged it into her phone. 15 seconds earlier, someone had opened the door to her apartment. The alarm was not connected to any security company. Its only purpose was to alert her that someone had broken in or had opened the door in some other way. After 30 seconds, an alarm bell would go off, and the uninvited visitor would get an unpleasant surprise in the form of a paint bomb hidden in a fake fuse box next to the door. She smiled in anticipation and counted down the seconds. Blomqvist stared in frustration at the alarm display by the door. For some reason, he hadn't even thought that the apartment might have an alarm. He watched the digital clock counting down. Millennium's alarm was triggered if someone failed to key in the correct 4-digit code within 30 seconds, and shortly thereafter a couple of muscular guys from a security company would come through the door. His first impulse was to close the door and make a quick exit from the building, but he just stood there, frozen to the spot. 4 digits. Impossible to guess the code at random. 25, 24, 23, 22. Damn, Pippi Long. 19, 18. What code would you use? 15, 14, 13. He felt his panic growing. 10, 9, 8. Then he raised his hand and desperately punched in the only number he could think of. 9277. The numbers that corresponded to the letters WASP on the keypad. To his astonishment, the countdown stopped, with 6 seconds to go. Then the alarm beeped one last time, before the display was reset to zero, and a green light came on. Salander opened her eyes wide.
She thought she had to be seeing things, and actually shook her PDA, which she realized was irrational. The countdown had stopped 6 seconds before the paint bomb was supposed to explode, and a second later the display reset to zero.
Impossible.
No other person in the world knew the code.
How could it be possible?
The police?
No.
Zala? Inconceivable. She dialed a number on her mobile and waited for the surveillance camera to connect and begin to send low-resolution images through. The camera was hidden in what looked like a smoke detector in the hall ceiling, and it took a low-res photograph every second. She played back the sequence from zero, the moment the door was opened and the alarm activated. Then a lopsided smile spread across her face as she looked down at Mikhail Blomqvist, who for half a minute acted out a jerky pantomime before he finally punched in the code and then leaned on the door jamb looking as though he had just avoided having a heart attack. Kalle fucking Blomqvist had tracked her down. He had the keys she had dropped on Lundegarten. He was smart enough to remember that Wasp was her handle on the net. And if he had found the apartment, then he had probably also worked out that it was owned by Wasp Enterprises. As she watched, he began to move jerkily down the hall and disappeared from the camera's view.
Shit! How could I have been so predictable? And why did I drop those keys?
Now her every secret lay open to Blomqvist's prying eyes. After thinking about it for a couple of minutes, she decided that it no longer made any difference. She had erased the hard drive. That was the important thing. It could even be to her advantage that he was the one to have found her hideout. He already knew more of her secrets than anyone else did. Practical Pig would do the right thing. He would not sell her out. She hoped. She put the car in drive and pressed on, deep in thought, towards Göteborg. Eriksson ran into Paolo Roberto in the stairwell to Millennium's offices when she arrived at 8:30. She recognized him at once, introduced herself, and let him in. He had a bad limp. She smelled coffee and knew that Berger was already there.
"Hello, Erika. Thanks for agreeing to see me at such short notice," the boxer said.
Berger studied the impressive collection of bruises and lumps on his face before she leaned forward and gave him a kiss on the cheek.
"You look like shit," she said.
"I've broken my nose before. What are you keeping, Blomqvist?"
"He's out somewhere playing detective, looking for leads. As usual, it's impossible to get hold of him. Except for a strange email last night, I haven't heard from him since yesterday morning. Thank you for... well, thanks."
She pointed to his face. Paolo Roberto laughed.
"Would you like coffee? You said you had something to tell me. Marlene, join us."
They sat in the comfortable chairs in Berger's office.
"It's that big blonde fucker I had the fight with. I told Mikhail that his boxing wasn't worth a rotten lingonberry, but the funny thing was, he kept assuming the defensive position with his fists and circled around as if he were a boxer. It seemed as if he had actually had some sort of training."
"Mikhail mentioned that on the phone yesterday," Eriksson said.
"I couldn't stop thinking about it. So yesterday, when I got home, I sat down and sent out emails to boxing clubs all over Europe. I described what had happened and gave as detailed a description as I could of the guy."
"Did you have any luck?"
"I think I got a nibble."
He put a faxed photograph on the table in front of Berger and Eriksson. It looked to have been taken during a training session at a boxing club. Two boxers were standing listening to instructions from a heavy-set older man in a narrow-brimmed leather hat and tracksuit. Half a dozen people were hanging around the ring listening. In the background stood a large man who looked like a skinhead. A circle had been drawn around him with a marker pen.
"The picture is 17 years old. The guy in the background is Ronald Niedermann. He was 18 when the picture was taken, so he should be about 35 now. That fits with the giant that kidnapped Miriam Wu. I can't say with 100% certainty that it's him. The picture is a little too old and it's poor quality, but I can say that he looks quite similar."
"Where did you get the picture?"
"I got an answer from Hans Munster, a veteran trainer at Dynamic in Hamburg. Ronald Niedermann boxed for them for a year in the late 80s. Or rather, he tried to box for them. I got the email first thing this morning and called Munster before I came here. To sum up what Munster said, Niedermann is from Hamburg, and hung out with a skinhead gang in the 80s. He has a brother a few years older, a very talented boxer, and it was through him that he joined the club. Niedermann had fearsome strength, and a physique that was almost unparalleled. Munster said that he'd never seen anyone hit so hard, not even among the elite. They measured the weight of his punch one time, and he went right off the scale.
It sounds as though he could have made a career in the ring, Berger said.
Paolo Roberto shook his head.
According to Munster, he was impossible, for several reasons. First, he couldn't learn to box. He would stand still throwing haymakers. He was phenomenally clumsy. That fits the guy I fought in Nietzsche. But what was worse, he didn't understand his own strength. Now and then he'd land a punch that would cause a horrible injury during sparring practice. There were broken noses and jaws. A whole series of unnecessary injuries. I just couldn't keep him around.
So he could box, but not really. Is that it?
Erickson said.
Exactly. But the reason for him stopping was medical.
How do you mean?
He was apparently invulnerable. It didn't matter how many punches he took. He just shook them off and kept fighting. It turned out that he suffers from a very rare condition called congenital analgesia. I looked it up. It's an inherited genetic defect that means the transmitter substance in his nerve synapses doesn't function properly. Or in lay terms, he can't feel pain.
That sounds like a gold mine for a boxer.
Paolo Roberto shook his head once more.
On the contrary, it can be a life-threatening disorder. Most people with congenital analgesia die relatively young, between 20 and 25. Pain is the body's warning system that something's wrong. If you put your hand on a red-hot burner, it hurts, and you snatch it away. But if you have this disease, you don't do anything until you start smelling burned flesh.
Erickson and Berger looked at each other.
Are you serious? Berger said.
Absolutely. Niedermann can't feel a thing. And he goes around as if he's had a massive dose of local anaesthesia 24 hours a day. He's managed to deal with it because he has another genetic feature that compensates for it. He has an extraordinary build with an extremely strong skeleton, which makes him almost invulnerable. His raw strength is damn near unique. And above all, he must heal easily.
I'm beginning to understand what an interesting boxing match it must have been.
It certainly was that. I wouldn't want to do it again. The only thing that made an impression on him was when Miriam Wu kicked him in the balls. He actually fell to his knees for a second. Which must be because there's some sort of physical reaction connected to a blow of that type, since he doesn't feel any pain. And believe me, even I would have collapsed if she had kicked me like that.
So how did you end up beating him?
People with this disease can in fact be injured just like anyone else. Forget that Niedermann seems to have bones of concrete. But when I whacked him with a plank on the back of his head, he dropped like a rock. He was probably concussed.
Berger looked at Erickson.
I'll call me Kyle, Erickson said.
Blomqvist heard his mobile go off, but he was so stunned that he did not answer until the fifth ring.
Hi, it's Marlin. Paolo Roberto thinks he's identified the giant.
That's good. Blomqvist said absent-mindedly.
Where are you?
That's hard to say.
You sound funny.
Sorry, what did you say? Erickson summed up Paolo Roberto's story.
Follow up on it, Blomqvist said, and see if you can find him in some database. I think it's urgent. Call me on my mobile.
To Erickson's surprise, he disconnected without even saying goodbye. Blomqvist was standing at that moment by a window, looking out at a magnificent view that stretched far from Gamlestan towards Solchun. He felt numb. There was a kitchen off the hall to the right of the front door. Then there was a living room, an office, a bedroom, and even a small guest room that seemed not to have been used. The mattress was still in its plastic wrapper, and there were no sheets. All the furniture was brand new, straight from IKEA. What floored Blomqvist was that Salander had bought the pied-à-terre that had belonged to Percy Banovic, a captain of industry. The apartment was about 3,800 square feet and worth 25 million kronor. Blomqvist wandered through deserted, almost eerily empty corridors and rooms with patterned parquet floors of different kinds of wood, and Tricia Guild wallpaper of the type that Berger had at one time coveted. At the centre of the apartment was a wonderfully bright living room with an open fireplace. But Salander seemed never to have had a fire. There was an enormous balcony with a fantastic view. There was a laundry room, a sauna, a gym, storage rooms, and a bathroom with a king-sized bath. There was even a wine cellar which was empty except for an unopened bottle of Quinta do Noval Port, Nacional, from 1976. Blomqvist struggled to imagine Salander with a glass of port in her hand. An elegant card indicated that it had been a moving-in present from the estate agent. The kitchen contained all manner of equipment, with a shiny French gourmet stove with a gas oven as the focus. Blomqvist had never before set eyes on a La Grenue Chateau 120. Salander probably used it for boiling tea water. On the other hand, he admired with awe the espresso machine on its own separate table. She had a Jura Impressa X7 with an attached milk cooler. The machine looked barely used and had probably been in the kitchen when she bought the apartment. Blomqvist knew that a Jura was the espresso equivalent of a Rolls-Royce, a professional machine for domestic use that cost in the neighbourhood of 70,000 kroner. He had an espresso machine that he had bought at John Wall, which had cost around 3,500 kroner, one of the few extravagances he had allowed himself for his own household, at a fraction of the grandeur of Salander's machine. The refrigerator contained an open milk carton, some cheese, butter, caviar, and a half-empty jar of pickled gherkins. The kitchen cupboard contained four half-empty jars of vitamins, tea bags, coffee for an ordinary coffee maker, two loaves of bread, and a packet of crisp breads. On the kitchen table was a bowl of apples. There were three ham pies and a fish casserole in the freezer. That was all the food he found in the apartment. In the trash under the counter next to the stove, he saw several empty packages for Billy's pan pizza. The arrangement was all out of proportion. Salander had stolen several billion kroner and bought herself an apartment with space for an entire court. But she only needed the three rooms she had furnished. The other 18 rooms were empty. Blomqvist ended his tour in her office. There were no flowers anywhere. There were no paintings or even posters on the walls. There were no rugs or wall hangings. He could not see a single decorative bowl, candlestick, or even a knick-knack that had been saved for sentimental reasons. Blomqvist felt as if someone was squeezing his heart. He felt that he had to find Salander and hold her close. She would probably bite him if he tried. Fucking Zalachenko. Then he sat down at her desk and opened the folder with Björk's report from 1991. He did not read it all, but skimmed through it, trying to absorb the essentials. He booted up her PowerBook with a 17-inch screen, 200-gigabyte hard drive and 1,000 megabytes of RAM. It was empty. She had wiped it. That was ominous. He opened her desk drawer and found a 9mm Colt 1911 government single action with a fully loaded magazine, 7 rounds. It was the pistol Salander had taken from the journalist Sandstrom, though Blomqvist knew nothing about that. He had not yet reached the letter S on the list of Johns. Then he found a DVD marked Bjurman. He stuck it into his iBook and watched its contents with horror. He sat in stunned silence as he saw Salander beaten up, raped, almost murdered. The film seemed to have been made with a hidden camera. He did not watch it all, but skipped from one section to the next, each worse than the last. Bjurman. Salander's guardian had raped her, and she had documented the event to the final detail. A digital date showed that the film had been recorded 2 years earlier. That was before he met her. Pieces of the puzzle were falling into place. Björk and Bjurman together with Zalachenko in the 70s. Zalachenko and Salander and a Molotov cocktail made from a milk carton in the early 90s. Then Bjurman again, now her guardian having replaced Palmgren. The circle had been closed. Bjurman had attacked his ward. He had treated her as a mentally ill, defenceless girl, but Salander was anything but defenceless. She was the girl who at the age of 12 had gone to war with a hit man who had defected from the GRU, and she had crippled him for life.
Salander was the woman who hated men who hate women. He thought back to the time when he had come to know her in Hedestad. It must have been a matter of months after the rape. He could not recall that she had hinted by so much as a single word that any such thing